I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Using figures from the Department of Justice, advocates of criminal justice reform estimate that more than 250,000 Americans are behind bars for drug offenses, a place where those who need it are unlikely to receive treatment for their addictions. In this hour, we take a look at the war on drugs in Baltimore and O'Malley-era zero-tolerance policing and their effect on the relationship between police and citizens. Neil Franklin, a 34-year law enforcement veteran of the Maryland State Police and Baltimore PD, is now executive director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He joins us to explain why he views the war on drugs as a policy failure, and in his words, a war on people that contributed to Baltimore's recent unrest. First, the news. Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Two-hour show, two subjects today, guns and drugs. In the second hour, guns. Two boys, ages 8 and 10, were among five shooting victims in Baltimore over the weekend as gunfire continued to erupt across the city in June following a record-matching month of violence in May. Three more homicides by gun over the weekend in Baltimore. Coming up in the second hour, a conversation about guns in American life with a Baltimore-based scholar, an associate professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Furman de Brabender, who wonders if firearms make us free and safe as advocates for their wide ownership claim. That's coming up, that conversation, in the second hour of our show today. Last year, the Prison Policy Initiative, tracks incarceration in the U.S. and opposes the mass incarceration we've seen in recent decades. The Prison Policy Initiative, using figures from the Department of Justice, estimated that at least 250,000 people were serving time in state or federal prison for a drug offense. That number does not include people who are also serving time for other more serious offenses. Someone serving time for both drug offenses and murder, for instance, would only be reported under the murder charge. So that's just drug offenses. According to the Department of Justice, drug possession arrests increased 80% from 1990 to 2010, reaching a high of 1.8 million in 2007. Here in Maryland, about 49,000 people were arrested for drug offenses in 2013, making up one-fifth of total arrests. Half of these arrests involve marijuana. Of the total drug offense arrests, 79% were for possession, while 21% were for the sale and manufacture of drugs. Today, we take another look at the war on drugs, a war some have called a failure, as thousands of arrests each year for possession and distribution seem to make no dent in the supply of drugs on the street or the demand. Baltimore faces an acute drug problem, especially with the rise in heroin use. A recent joint study by the Justice Policy Institute and the group I mentioned, the Prison Policy Initiative, found that Maryland spends, taxpayers spend, $300 million to incarcerate people from Baltimore City who account for one out of three people in the state prison system. In Freddie Gray's neighborhood of Sandtown Winchester on the west side, the incarceration rate is eight times that of the state of Maryland's rate. And Freddie Gray was himself caught up in the war on drugs, which we'll talk about in this hour a little bit. Is this the best way to spend billions of dollars each year? Some argue that arresting dealers is the only way to cut off drug supplies and that prosecution is a deterrent for both potential dealers and users. Last year, Maryland made possession of a small amount of marijuana punishable by a $100 fine. But just a few weeks ago, Governor Larry Hogan vetoed legislation that would have decriminalized public smoking of marijuana and legalized marijuana paraphernalia. Today, we welcome back to Midday Neil Franklin. Neil Franklin is a 34-year law enforcement veteran. He served at the Maryland State Police, where he did some narcotics work, a fair amount of narcotics work, and he was with the Baltimore Police Department, too. As I said, he served as a narcotics agent early in his career and as a commander for the Bureau of Drug and Criminal Enforcement. And then when he was with the Baltimore Police Department, Neil Franklin led the Training and Education Division. Today, Neil Franklin is executive director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a nonprofit made up of current and former members of law enforcement who believe that the country's drug policies fail to reduce crime or address the public health issue of drug abuse. LEAP proposes that government regulation of drugs, taking drugs off the black market, is a better method of preventing crime than what we have now, the criminalization of drug use. Neil Franklin, it's nice to have you back on the Midday Show.
Hey, Dan, it's great to be back. Thank you.
Yeah, it's interesting timing having you back here. And so it's the first time I've had a chance to talk to you since, well, the death of Freddie Gray and everything that followed after that. So I wonder, were your observations about not only Freddie Gray's death, but people's reactions to it, all the demonstrations, and then we can talk about the riots later, but first, the reaction to that young man's death, what did that tell you about your Baltimore?
Well, first of all, I'm not surprised. I mean, as we continue to try to solve a public health crisis in this country with criminal justice solutions, this is where we're going to end up. We're going to continue to end up with a Freddie Gray or Eric Garner or Tamir Rice or a number of these unfortunate deaths. We're going to continue down this road of this conflict between police and community. You know, it seems like whenever we have some sort of social crisis, we think that the police are the solution to it, or a major part of the solution to it, and we tend to put them out in front. And that's what we've done here with the drug war. You know, with in Baltimore City, and the uniqueness about Baltimore City is that we have so many pockets of open-air drug markets. We have so much plight in the city. It's not isolated to one section of the city, like East Baltimore or West Baltimore or Southwest, where you can kind of like cordon things off and concentrate your efforts. It's literally peppered throughout this city, from east to west to southwest, northeast, northwest. And that makes it even more difficult. And this whole problem of drug prohibition, you know, in the drug war, I mean, every day we talk to people about this issue and they say that, you know, well, yeah, we all know that the drug war has failed. But it hasn't just failed. You see, because it's counterproductive to public safety. The drug war actually does something. It doesn't lie dormant there as it has failed and we can just meander around, you know, for the next few years or decades as we try to figure out a new path forward. The longer it stays in place, the more damage it does. It's a cancer. It causes crime. It sets the foundation for violent crime, especially in those communities where you have so much plight, where people have nothing, where people have no hope. They have no money. They have no jobs. And on top of that, many of these people, like in Sandtown, are saddled with a criminal conviction from decades of this disastrous policy. So it compounds the issue. And when you're in that state of existence, you know, you will get desperate and you will do anything.
And there are also constant encounters with the police if you're in one of those neighborhoods.
On a daily basis.
In the case of Freddie Gray, you know, I looked at his record several weeks ago. The record on Freddie Gray reveals a young man who had frequent encounters with police as they carried out the local drug war, right. War on drugs. And, you know, he was arrested a number of times. One time he was convicted of illegal drug possession when he was 18 years old, but he mostly avoided jail time. If you look at the court records, you see not guilty verdicts. Mm-hmm. You see cases dropped, closed, or put on the inactive docket stat. There's one, I think there was one probation after conviction for a drug charge more recently, last summer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are kind of typical, sort of like the typical charges you see when police frequently suspect someone of being a street-level drug dealer.
Right.
But, I mean, there wasn't much there, actually, with Freddie Gray, yet I think that's what made him familiar to police officers, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, so he was familiar with them, they were familiar with him, and so they pull up, and whether he's involved in something or not,
yeah.
The scenario is he's probably going to put some distance in between him and the police, and then the police end up chasing him and pursuing
him. Right.
But, you know, when you think about this, You were talking about the many arrests that he had had for drug charges and didn't do any time. And, of course, the arrest doesn't mean that the probable cause is there for conviction and that the evidence is there for conviction. But let's just go back briefly to 2005 when we made 108,000 arrests in a city of 620,000 people. And we know that somewhere around 20%, if not more, of those arrests, state's attorney's office said there was no probable cause for the arrest to occur in the first place. But that arrest still remains on that person's record in cyberspace and in these databases that is discoverable by people, you know, who may be potential employers for that person.
Right.
You know, and even, you know, so many of those arrests were for such minor charges. Again, once you put so many people in a position of having to explain, that's if they get the opportunity to explain an arrest, you know, as they sit before an employer, but most of them never get that opportunity because they have to indicate it on their application, or it just shows up on an iPad or on your laptop or computer as you're someone who's hiring people for a job. So you just set those applications aside, and it keeps those people in a place of disenfranchisement and keeps them in a place of extreme poverty. So when something does happen, like, you know, the riots that we just had, those people are going to do whatever they can to take it, unfortunately, take advantage of that situation. And I don't think any of us think that it's right to go out and destroy someone's property and put people's lives in danger. Absolutely not. But you shouldn't be surprised that that happened.
Neil Franklin, you had, what, 23-plus years with the state police, am I right?
Yes.
And then you worked with the Baltimore City Police Department. You had the rank of lieutenant colonel, I believe?
Yeah, I ended up with the rank of lieutenant colonel.
Right. And what years were you with the Baltimore Police Department?
From 2000 to 2004.
Okay, so that was during the time Martin O'Malley was mayor, and he had come into office promising to get tough on crime, and to put in place a strategy that everyone calls zero tolerance strategy, quality of life crimes, the focus, abetting situations, arresting people to alleviate situations on street corners, clean up street corners. Anyway, and that number that you allude to, 108,000 in 2005, that was the high point, I think, for the arrest during that period.
Right.
A lot of people, and I've even mentioned this in my column a few times about that period of time, that while the violent crime numbers went down in Baltimore City during that period, they also went down elsewhere in the country during that time.
Absolutely.
But, you know, you have to wonder about what kind of damage was done in terms of police and communities during that period of time when so many people were being arrested multiple times in some cases.
Right. And unfortunately, under these policies of drug prohibition, again, which we're trying to get rid of, unfortunately, you've got to have some level of enforcement, you know, of these drug laws, which is very problematic, like we've said. But since you have to have the enforcement of these drug laws at some level, on the other side of that, you need something to balance that out, and which is a very strong and comprehensive community policing system in place. Now, I'm just talking about law enforcement initiatives here. There's so many other factors, education, jobs, job training, job placement, housing, health issues, treatment, so many other things that come into play as it relates to the thriving of a community. But from a law enforcement perspective, if you're going to be out there proactively enforcing drug laws, first of all, you need to push possession offenses down to the lowest possible level and just deal with the violence surrounding the drug trade itself. And but on the other side of that, you've got to have some very, very strong community policing piece that is responsible for establishing and maintaining those relationships with people in the community. Because when you have that strong enforcement side, you know what? Things are going to happen. You're going to have mistakes. You're going to make mistakes, you know, and people are going to get hurt. And when that happens, then you've got to have the support of that investment on a community policing side, you know, and so that the citizens understand, number one, that they can trust you because they have a relationship with you, that there's going to be some transparency, and that you are going to keep them abreast and current with what's happening with any investigation that takes place.
But you still have to get to the bad guys, right? You still have to get to those who are killing in order to protect commerce.
But understand what the killing is about. That killing is about managing those corners for selling dope.
Right. So to get to them, right. The theory with zero tolerance or broken windows and all of that was if you start at the lowest possible level by arresting people for, you know, what seem like, what are misdemeanors or mm-hmm. even less than that, that you would eventually would get information that would lead you to the bad guys.
That's the theory, but here's what happens long term, the carnage of what we're experiencing now, which we refer to as the chickens coming home to roost. All those low-level offenses, you've now put those people who may have had an opportunity to turn their lives around or to head into another direction because of the constant arresting of these people, you put them in a place where they're no longer viable for employment opportunities. You put them in a place where they're going to have housing challenges and so on. You're not tending to the addiction issues that they have.
You're creating other problems.
Think
in
about
the
numbers that you just. Yeah, think about yeah. the numbers that you just gave yeah. when you opened the show mm-hmm. about how many of those, what percentage of those arrests were possession related. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people. Those are tens of thousands of people who are now, you know, put in this category, this caste system, as Michelle Alexander says, who is the author of The New Jim Crow, put into this caste system. Of where they're just an unemployable section, you know, of the population. And that's not what we should. And a lot of these people are young people, you know, and we could have given them an opportunity to move into a place of employment and changing themselves, you know, turning themselves around, keeping them in a place of education. And they need support. I mean, you got to understand, we've had decades of these drug laws that have devastated family units in this city, black families in this city and other cities across this country. And when you separated family members like that and the cohesiveness of a family, someone else has to step in to give those people, those young people, the support that they need so that they can make it.
And we end up doing that.
Right.
The society.
Absolutely.
Foster care.
And it's far more costly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Neil Franklin, we'll come back and talk some more. Neil Franklin, now Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, we'll talk to him a little bit about how he made this transition from one side to the other on the drug war. Or maybe you always had some ambivalence. I don't know. Maybe I got to examine that with
there
you.
There was always some there, but just a couple of key moments.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk some more. Neil Franklin, and you're welcome to give us a ring, too, if you have any comments or questions. 410-662-8780. Do arrests for petty drug offenses send a discouraging message to potential buyers and sellers? Or do you think this war is a failure? 410-662-8780, and we ought to call it off. And Neil Franklin with us today, Executive Director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. So I said before the break there, back when you worked for the state police in narcotics, was there ever any ambivalence about what you were doing?
Yeah, there were a couple of moments before one significant one. But the first one, I guess, was when I was a lieutenant in planning and research for a brief period, and I ended up on the NIDO Exchange Program Board here in Baltimore City as a uniformed police officer. And that was under Mayor Schmoke and Peter Bielenson, the health commissioner, mm-hmm. When they instituted NIDO Exchange. They needed a law enforcement member on board, and so the state assigned me as a lieutenant with the Maryland State Police to be on that board. And that's when I started getting a glimpse into just how extensive the drug war was and how it played a significant role in disease, the spread of AIDS, HIV, through intervenous drug use. So I was kind of like educated by Peter Bielenson and Mayor Schmoke. Mm-hmm. But then Mayor Schmoke was also talking about the violence that he had seen when he was the prosecutor before he was elected mayor. And then I was thinking, wow, yeah, I've seen some of that violence that he's talking about. Because I knew Marty Ward, and Mayor Schmoke speaks about Marty Ward being that undercover detective here in Baltimore City who was killed in an apartment doing a undercover drug buy.
Marcellus Ward. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll forget that case.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so having that glimpse of you know, what was happening. And then when I was a major with the Maryland State Police and regional commander for the Bureau of Drug and Criminal Enforcement, I had a young trooper come into me one day, and Sean says to me, well, he put in a request to see me because he wasn't happy with his evaluation because he had been graded low in initiative. And I said, well, you just got to get out there and make some more cases, have some initiative. And he said, well, the teams are farming me. I said, my sergeant is loaning me out to so many other task forces because I'm one of the few black undercover investigators out there that they're loaning me around to all these other places on the Eastern Shore and some on the Western Shore, which told me that kind of like sounds like we're targeting these few black communities here on the Eastern Shore. So it led me to believe and start thinking about that we've got some problems here. But then when Ed Totley was killed in 2000.
Who was Ed Totley again?
Ed Totley was an undercover state trooper working with the FBI down in Washington, D.C. And when he was killed making a buy of cocaine by a mid-level drug dealer, and he was shot at point-blank range, that was kind of like the straw on the camel's back that really got me doing research and actually to start speaking openly about this. And at that time, I was with the Baltimore Police Department. So I was a uniformed member of law enforcement when I started speaking about the failures of this policy.
We had a former police officer call here a few weeks ago. I'll never forget the conversation because toward the end of it, he was reflecting on excessive force, relationships between young men in the community and police officers, and how police officers treat young men, and why sometimes police officers do what they do. He was trying to explain something, but toward the end of the conversation, I asked him why he was no longer a police officer, because he sounded fairly young still, and he had gone into counseling, I believe, and he said, I just got tired of arresting my own people. Arresting African-American young men is what he meant.
Yeah.
In fact, he said that. So I wondered, you know, did that thought ever come to you as well? And do you ever hear that from other law enforcement officers?
Yeah, I do hear it quite a bit from law enforcement officers, the men and women in the streets. And unfortunately for me, I didn't realize, you know, you're in this silo of policing, and you're kind of like isolated and cut off from other parts of society. You know, as you got these blinders on and you're going about your job. But when I did completely step away and kind of like remove myself from doing that kind of work and take a look back, yeah, I'm not very proud of the number of young black men that I ended up arresting doing that work or had some whatever role in doing that work.
You know, this. Anyone who's read my newspaper column knows how I feel about the war on drugs. I think it's time to stop. So, but I need you to help me understand something. What happens next if we just stop? If we just stop, meaning if we just stop arresting people for selling drugs, for possessing, we can start with possession, but then selling drugs. I mean, a total end to this would be, end of prohibition would be all of that.
Yeah.
But I wonder what happens next, though, because people, there's still a demand for heroin, demand for cocaine. People want to smoke marijuana. You know, so where does that business go if we just stop arresting people?
Personally, I would love to just stop. I would think that just the absence of the policy would just make such a difference. It wouldn't, you know, solve and handle some of the other issues that we currently have on the health side of this. But I would love to just stop. But why can't we in this country take a look at what other countries are doing and learn from them? I you know, is it a pride thing? I don't know what it is.
And yeah, we don't like to do that. When it comes to health insurance, for instance, we resisted that for a long time. Still resisted.
I guess we.
So, but if you want
to be number one,
well, if you want to bring that up, okay. But I mean, my question
and
is,
the reason
what do you see as the American model, though, Neil? Because I know you've had time to think about this.
Yeah. First, let's just stop arresting people for possessing these small amounts of drugs, all drugs. And I say that because I continue to look at some countries. Let's look at Portugal. They did so 13 years ago.
What did they do?
They stopped arresting people for small amounts of drugs, all drugs, a 10-day personal supply, no matter what the drug is. they decided to treat this issue as a public health concern, a problem, not one of criminal justice. So when you're caught with these drugs in Portugal, and it's obvious that you're not selling it, your personal supply, you're sent before a medical panel, a board, and they make a determination as to whether or not you have an addiction problem or if you're just someone that likes to use drugs.
And what if you're selling?
If you're selling, it's still ill. It's still a criminal offense. Okay. Still a criminal offense at this point.
But simple possession, that's what they do with you.
All right. And from making this shift, now anybody that has an addiction issue, now that they have so much, they're saving so much money on the enforcement side, they now have on-demand treatment. Okay, so they can go right into to treatment. They've also changed their educational program in their schools so that they're actually bringing a healthcare practitioner, not a police officer, to teach about the properties of drugs and what they do and how they affect your body. They do that a couple times a year, and it's making a huge difference. Here are some of the results. They've had a 52% reduction in overdose deaths in Portugal. You know how many people, how many lives that would be here in the United States? They've had a 71% reduction in new cases of HIV for intravenous drug users, another big lifesaver. But what about the kids? What kind of message are you sending? Well, middle and high school kids, a 22 to 25% reduction in overall drug use among those. Because
they put some effort into education.
They put effort into education, proper education, truth, fact-based, science-based education. It's no longer, as I interviewed this 14-year-old Portuguese young girl on a plane, on a flight once in South America. And I had to ask, a 3-minute interview, but the most poignant question that I asked her was, so how do you young people view drug use in your country? And she says, well, it's ordinary. It's no big deal. You know, it's no longer this whole criminal thing. And she said, and I asked her, I said, so how do you young people feel about the police? She says, we love the police. They're there to help us whenever.
Did you ask if she fears being helped? Did you ask if she fears addiction?
No, I didn't okay. ask her that. But she says that in the educational piece, the healthcare practitioner comes into the school twice a year, teaches them everything about drugs. They ask questions about drugs, and mm-hmm. she says, then we just make a decision. And she says, most of us choose not to because right. it doesn't make sense to use once you know what those drugs are.
Right. It would be the same rap as you would give young people about alcohol.
Absolutely. Right? And we're having success in this country with not just alcohol, but think of tobacco, because we're teaching people the truth, the facts about these products and what they do to you, how they harm your body. And with tobacco, over the past couple of decades, we've had about a 40% reduction in overall use. And we're not having street battles. We're not sending people to prison. Yes, we have somewhat of an underground market, but I attribute that because we keep raising taxes on these tobacco products. And now we're starting to drive that underground somewhat. So you got to have balance again. And that's what we don't have.
Neil Franklin, Executive Director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a veteran of the Maryland State Police and the Baltimore Police Department, our guest on Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Let's go to the phone lines, Neil, and take some calls and get our listeners involved in this conversation. Ray in Baltimore. Ray, welcome to Midday. Ray, you there?
Yes.
Go right ahead, please.
Can you hear me?
Ray, go,
hello?
Yes, go right ahead, Ray.
How are you doing?
Yeah, just wanted to say I appreciate your guest. I think, though, it's too little too late. I think on the macro level, as America becomes more brown, the browning of America, I think these laws that have destroyed the black family, they will continue to exist. I think it's a deliberate mechanism to take cities back from African Americans as more jobs go back to the cities. But as the guest pointed out, I mean, you're taking an 18-year-old, you're giving him, he's not finishing high school, and then you give him a felon, and we felonize these kids for anything. So now you're 18 with a criminal record and no high school diploma. Where do you go from there? Racism is definitely the central theme of the drug war. And that's why it's not going to change, because when you mention that word, people get defensive and it goes away. The last point, if you look at shootings and how drugs are handled in other countries, I mean, and your guest was touching on this. It's just stunning. The only country that has a problem with police shootings of African Americans, like in this country, is South Africa, and we know the history there. And both of those are linked to the images that whites have for blacks. Those images perpetuate our criminal justice system.
Ray, thank you very much. He thinks it's too little too late to decriminalize, but actually, isn't the pendulum kind of swinging in your favor based on the polls that I see?
Yeah, we are moving in that area. What we have right now,
we've already seen laws have changed.
Yeah. And we have this huge movement right now, bipartisan effort of criminal justice reform, which involves changing our mandatory, restructuring our mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines, hopefully getting rid of them. How do we deal with recidivism? How do we do job training and job placement for those folks coming out of prison? Unfortunately, a lot of the reform efforts that we're seeing are on the back end of this system. We still have not yet figured out how we're going to cut off the pipeline of so many people going into the criminal justice system, especially now that we got our schools involved. I mean, we're putting younger and younger people into prison as we go forward, and that's not dealing with the front end of the problem. Again, the war on drugs is currently the largest part of the front end of this problem. That's how more people are going into the system. And I know some of your callers are saying, well, we're not locking up that many people for long term for drug possession and so on. We're locking up dealers, charging them with felons. And those people, again, most of the violence that we're having in Baltimore City is generated by this drug trade and the gangs and the crews that manage the drug trade in our neighborhoods as they fight and war with each other,
okay.
And then the police fight with them.
I'm with you on that. So if you take away, if you decriminalize drugs, end this prohibition,
right?
You would have to, there would still be a demand for drugs immediately, right?
So the main thing here is let's first shift to a health centered focus. In doing that, when you have on-demand treatment, and this is one of the significant things in Portugal and Switzerland and some other countries, when you focus on that addicted population, see, that's where most of the stuff is going. That's where most of the street corner sales are going. Now, if you focus on that population, pull them away from the street corners and into safe injection facilities and other facilities that provide treatment and wraparound services, you've now siphoned that population of people who are using drugs in large amounts on a daily basis. You just siphoned them away from the crews
from
and the gangs on the corner.
Okay, but for those those you don't get, because the market remains
right
in the immediate, maybe not in the long term, but the market is there. Are you suggesting that the state become the salesman of drugs? You're not suggesting that.
What I'm saying is there are many different models, whether it's a state-run system, whether it's a pharmacy-based model, whether it's some sort of private industry.
Amsterdam.
You got to understand, this is still a United States of America and capitalism. Right. Look what's happening with marijuana. It's not a state-run system. It was a state-managed and regulated system, like in Colorado, but the people who are involved in it aren't, the private companies that are actually producing and then selling to adults in a regulated market. Again, even if we had ended up having a regulated market for some of these drugs like heroin and cocaine, it's still going to be a lot better than what we have today with prohibition, where you have thousands of street corner shops who will sell to anyone, no matter what their age is, and they recruit children. Recruitment of kids is priority number one, pulling them out of schools, putting them on street corners so there is no continued education, and before you know it, they're involved in violence, they're carrying guns, and they're using them against each other and the police.
So even if you had the private market, you wouldn't have the collateral damage on the scale.
Not even close.
That you're talking about.
Not even close.
Neil Franklin, our guest, executive director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, 410-662-8780. We need to take a short break. We'll come back and take some phone calls. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Neil Franklin, executive director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're talking about the war on drugs. Do you think it should end? If it ends, then what? What kind of model would you like to see in its place for distribution of drugs that people would still be demanding? That's the question I have, Neil. Another question I have is, would we see more people experimenting with marijuana, heroin, cocaine, if we were just to end it, just to stop the war on drugs?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that is a question. Now, let me begin with first saying that, you know, even if we did, again, the fallout, the collateral damage of prohibition policies with the crime that's generated, the money that you're giving to these gangs and organized crime and the crews and the cartels, and which contributes to our immigration problem, why so many people want to come up here, that's a whole nother show. Mm-hmm. But the collateral damage from these policies that have not only failed but are counterproductive to public safety far outweighs any uptick in use. But then you then shift just a portion of those resources to deal with that, right, through education and through treatment, and that's where you go with that.
Andrew in Baltimore County, you're up next. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, how you doing? I just want to address the corruption in the war on drugs on the part of law enforcement and the government. I was watching a special on National Geographic, and it looks like they tend to go after, like, low-level drug dealers, the ones who's doing the back alleys, and people who are just selling, like, pharmacy pills in front of Lexington Market. So I was wondering why they don't really go after the distribution of drugs. It comes here from other places. They don't make the heroin in Baltimore. And it doesn't look like they're really going after the kingpins. So I don't really, I mean, I feel like if they were doing that more and breaking that up, there would be less drugs on the streets, per se.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was actually a time when we were going, and we put a lot of kingpins in prison. Baltimore City, I mean, we
and
six,
the DEA,
seven, eight, yeah, kingpins. We did the same all across the country.
I remember when I first got to Baltimore in the 70s, mm-hmm, and early 80s, they were drug kingpins whose names were known. They were, like, widely known,
oh,
in,
yeah,
the community because there weren't that many of them.
Right.
And then it sort of atomized. You know, it got smaller and smaller,
right,
levels, lower levels of people selling, a lot of people selling just to maintain their habits, too. Right.
Right? But here's the thing. You can't stop this stuff. It's so easily concealed. You can't stop it from coming into the country. If we were to just search, if we somehow found a way to economically search 10% of the cargo coming into this country, we'd slow commerce down so much that we'd have one hell of a depression. You just can't do it because there's so many goods coming into this country, yeah, by so many means. It's impossible to do it. I mean, as far as marijuana, even though there's been less coming in from Mexico now because we grow so much of it here. We grow it here. You just can't keep it from coming in. And if we haven't learned that by now, shame on it. So the answer is, how do we best learn to live with it safely? There are more things that are illegal in this country, by far, that are more harmful to our children and more harmful to our citizens than these drugs that we're talking about. But we learn how to live with them through education, treatment, and regulatory system to keep the products as safe as possible for use.
Another question. This is Elias in Baltimore. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay.
Thanks for putting me on.
Sure.
I totally agree with you about, you know, legalization, taking the power and the profit out of the hands of the drug dealers and then regulating it in a safe way. But what happens, you know, once we basically eliminate that black market, what happens to all those people who would be dealing drugs on the corners who are still out of a job? Like, how do we get those communities back to work?
Well, first of all, we're already dealing with a community that where there are no jobs. This isn't something that will, like, just happen next week. Okay, so it's going to take a process of job training. First of all, you're going to have to identify what the up-and-coming industry is in a particular area, because it's going to be different from community to community. Then you have to train people according to that, and then make those jobs available and bring business in and slowly move that population of people into that place. But the key here, and you may end up, there may be a generation that's really not going to recover at all from this as we would like, but we have to do something with this elementary school age group of kids right now. We have to identify them. We have to embrace them and their family units. And we have to put things in place to move that group of kids all the way through high school. See, the problem is we've had no long-term plans, either in this city or many of our other cities. We've got to have a 10 to 15 year plan to take that elementary school age group of kids all the way through high school so that they are marketable, and so that and that we don't give them criminal records. And by doing something with this drug war, we can prevent them from being recruited to the street corners and out of the classrooms into these dangerous environments. It's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of work. But if we properly shift the resources, not just financially, but human resources and interest to what I'm talking about, one of these long-term plans to deal with our elementary school kids, we can make this happen in 10 to 15 years.
It goes back to my question about what happens to the market after you stop the war on drugs.
Yeah, and there's
still a market. There's still a demand, and somebody is still selling it, right?
Someone's always going to be selling it.
Right, but it's a question of what model that or shape that takes in the future.
Right. The question is, since we know that someone's always going to be selling it, there's always going to be a great demand for it, the question is, who would you rather have managing it? If you think the cartels and organized crime and our neighborhood crews and gangs, which have shootings, we're seeing the shootings and murders here in Baltimore over the past month, you know, and the kidnappings and the witness intimidation murders and the police fighting. If you think that they're doing such a great job at managing this drug trade that's going to exist, whether you like it or not, it's here to stay. If you think they're doing such a great job, okay, we'll leave things as
leave
is.
Leave it alone.
But
right.
If you think we need to move that market to someplace else, fine.
All right.
Let's do it.
Here's John's call. John's in White Marsh with a question for us. Hi. John, are you there? You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is about Martin O'Malley's crackdown on drugs and crime. They did the same thing in New York City, and now when you go to Manhattan, it's fantastic. You have no apprehension whatsoever. What went wrong in Baltimore?
Well, Manhattan's completely different from Baltimore. I've been there many a times. I haven't seen any areas of plight and impoverished communities where people don't have money, no hope, no jobs, no nothing. Not in Manhattan. The problems in Manhattan, you had people coming in from some of the other outlying areas via the subway and other forms of transportation, committing crimes in Manhattan, which is the part of New York City that is, it's the rich.
It's very affluent. It's a critical mass of affluence. And there's also
Absolutely.
Been a lot more gentrification of neighborhoods in New York City. All that happened a lot faster than it has happened here.
Absolutely. Because the money's there.
That's the only explanation I can give you for that, because they certainly did arrest a lot of people and did a lot of stop and frisk.
Yeah. One of the worst things I hate to see is when people try to compare what happened in New York City with other places. And you know what? Even with what they've done in New York City, some of those other boroughs where you still have the poor communities in plight, you're still going to have the uptick in crime. Because it's cyclical, especially as long as we have this policy of drug prohibition in place.
Alan in Baltimore, go right ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. One of the problems I see with strictly the medicalization approach, and I have discussions about, get people into facilities for treatment or for legal use. One of the problems I've seen in central Baltimore specifically, and right down the street from your studio, is when you concentrate those treatment facilities in a single area, what you end up doing is concentrating the open-air drug market as well, because the people who are out there selling know that they've got a ready and willing client base coming in every day. And so, and Dan, you're familiar with the neighborhood around there. Walk to the street corners on North Avenue, on 25th Street, the bus stops. It is an open-air drug market, and I can't see how when you increase the number of facilities, concentrate those facilities, you don't run into that same problem all over again. So I think it needs to go beyond.
Excuse me, Alan. So how do you know it's an open-air drug market? You're talking about the methadone treatment facility?
Yes.
So how do you know it's an open-air drug market?
Look at the crime statistics around that community, and we have done that in central Baltimore. Look at the crime statistics. Number one reason for arrest, sale of benzodiazepines, which are used by methadone patients to restore the high. It's called boosting.
Mm-hmm.
Dozens and dozens of arrests every week. It's a constant problem, and it's very clear that the crime targets the patients, because they know you have, a ready supply of customers coming in, and many of them, we know drug treatment often fails. People don't always succeed. and the dealers are there. They know where the concentrations of patients are. They set up shop. You know, we've studied the problem, and it's...
Yeah, I don't know. What is the solution? People need to go to a clinic under the federal government's laws, and to get their sip of methadone, they need to show up a report. They do a urine test, and they have to sign a paper and all that. So that government makes them do that. What is the answer? What is the answer to having people go to a clinic for medical treatment? The police maybe do a better job of enforcing the law on the corner? I don't know that, Neil. I don't know if you have an answer for this one.
Well, one of the things we don't do, we don't properly service those people who are addicted with truly wraparound services as they do in some other countries.
We don't, and we also don't like to have such clinics in suburban areas. People in the outlying counties who think they don't have drug problems don't want to have treatment centers in their communities anywhere near them.
And so, if we're able to expand, you know, someone receiving this treatment to individual doctors' offices, and you know, which are, you know, under our Affordable Care Act or whatever Care Act that's going to be in place, whatever that health system is, if we're able to spread that out, and so, for instance, me.
What a neat idea, just go to your own doctor for treatment of your addiction.
What do we do with alcoholics? Do we concentrate them to one center someplace to go get, you know, their treatment? No. You do it through your family practitioner. You do it through your doctor and your health, your clinic that you typically go to for a broken arm or ear infection or whatever else. And that's how you get those services. We have to get to that place. And in order to do that, we have to remove the stigma, you know, from this issue. We shouldn't be treating someone who's addicted to heroin any differently than someone who's addicted to alcohol.
Time for another call. David in Baltimore, go right ahead. Hi.
Hi. I agree with what the gentleman is saying about everything he does. But one of the things is, as long as we have lawyers as politicians, we're going to have a problem, because that's their income or their buddy's income. If we take the money out of that too, I think the family structure is a problem that should be addressed. The school system, if there is no good, if, like the man said, if they don't have hope, we have to have better schools to begin with, the schools, the family, and taking the money out of it.
All right, David. Thank you very much. And Tony, on that point about the politics of the drug war, go right ahead, Tony.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Go ahead, please. We're short of time.
Yeah, I just want to mention that it's this kind of thinking outside the box that we have to convince politicians to look into this approach, because what they're doing now is obviously not working, and it's not working in any metropolitan city. I mean, I'm from New York City, and I was born and raised in poverty, and I've seen everything that's happening now. So, and what kind of saved me was I was into sports. And you see that there's no more rags around anymore for the kids. So, again, it's just this kind of, you know, thinking that's going to, you know, help this problem, because it is going to exist.
Yeah, Tony, good point, man, because, you know, if we, we've got to really focus again on our young people, you know, getting them back into doing busy things, you know, since the war on drugs has already ripped apart these families, as I mentioned earlier, mainly black and brown families, you know, unfortunately now the kids are left to the rest of us to support and do something with. So that's where we need to put our resources. And yes, David, I'm telling you, we've let this thing go so long now that corporate America is making so much money. When I say corporate America, yes, I'm talking about attorneys, I'm talking about private prisons and so on, making so much money on the war on drugs, it's hard to end it.
Neil Franklin is Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He lives right here in Maryland. Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is LEAP. Are you leap.org?
Leap.cc, LEAP.cc.
.cc.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for clearing that up. Yeah, Neil, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your insights. Thanks for what you're doing. Take some lunch, please. Rosina Gourmet has provided lunch for our guests today. Rosina Gourmet, located in Canton, downtown Baltimore and Harbor East. We have another hour of midday coming up, so please stay tuned for the news, and we'll see you after that.